From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. As an economic policy and as a political concept, austerity seems to be the governing idea of the moment. And on its face, it makes sense. We're in debt because we spent too much on government. So we get out of it by cutting and getting this government spending out of the way, because that frees up the market, which inspires confidence, which leads to growth. Mark Blyth says it doesn't work that way. In fact, he calls the policy of austerity dangerous nonsense, because more often than not, he says, it produces the outcome you're trying to avoid. In other words, austerity creates more debt. It's controversial, this idea. Today on the program, Blyth is joining us to make his case. We'll talk about the history of austerity as an idea and how it's worked or not worked in practice. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Let's be honest. Economic policy is complicated. The factors that play into any theory can seem pretty Byzantine. But a few months ago, during a speech in San Francisco, the political economist Mark Blyth summed up why he had written his new book.
I wrote this book for the following reason. I got really, really pissed off with people with lots of money telling people who don't have any money they need to pay shit back.
And there it is, in a nutshell, his case against austerity policy. Austerity, of course, is the idea that you slash government programs to get rid of all of this debt. And it's become a governing principle in a lot of countries these days. But Blyth says the concept, the idea, is completely wrong. In fact, he says it's dangerous nonsense. That is, in fact, creating more debt and slowing economic growth and increasing inequality. His book is called Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. And today in the program, he's joining us to talk about it. Mark Blyth is a professor of international political economy at Brown University. And he's joining us today from a studio in Brookline, Massachusetts. And Professor Blyth, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Very nice to be with you.
Well, there are a number of reasons as to why austerity has become the governing idea of the moment, as you put it. And we're going to get to them as we go. But it's interesting. I wanted you to talk about the kind of personal relationship you have with austerity, because you mentioned this in the preface of your book. You say, in fact, your upbringing in Dundee, Scotland, was, in the original sense of the word, austere. Talk about that part that's sort of making you think about all of this.
Oh, sure. So I grew up in what you would call poverty. My mother died when I was very young, and my care was given over to my paternal grandmother. And our income in the family, such as it was the state retirement pension for a single woman in the late 1960s, which wasn't very much money at all. So I really did go to school with holes in my shoes. Now, the interesting thing was, back in the day, the schools that I went to actually acted as ladders of social mobility for those who were given the chance of the genetic lottery of life to basically excel academically. Mm. And from there, I went to a university that was heavily subsidized. And then I went to graduate school in the United States, and now I'm an Ivy League professor. So I am possibly the greatest example of intergenerational social mobility you're ever likely to run into. Mm. And what bothers me on a deep personal level about austerity politics is, when you're cutting government spending, what you're doing is stopping the next me getting that chance. And when you have a highly skewed income distribution, as we do in the United States and indeed throughout the developed world over the past 30 years, it's gotten more and more unequal. You're skewing the game. You're basically creating an insider politics where those with all of the assets and the incomes get all of the chances and lock it in at the top. And then we're cutting away the possibility of growth and mobility for those at the bottom. And I think that is dangerous.
Let me ask you, what is the kind of rhetoric that you're hearing around the idea of austerity? I mean, you hear, you know, the welfare state, bloated, paternalistic, all of this spending going out. I mean, what kind of language are you hearing in the dialogue about all of this?
Well, precisely that there's been this, you know, sort of, how can I put it, this period of out-of-control government spending, and therefore we need to check on what we're doing and cut that spending. But let's remember something. Back in 2006, when debt to GDP in the United States was 61%, I don't remember a single congressman jumping up and down screaming about the debt. In fact, I just remember people saying, aren't things wonderful? I'm using my house as an ATM. Let's have another round of tax cuts. So there's no downside for a Democratic politician to basically gamble on the upside of a bubble. And when we do this, we cut taxes. So we end up basically taxing at about 17% of GDP for federal expenditure. But then we actually spend at 25%. Well, that difference is your deficit. Multiply that over time. Throw in a couple of wars of choice without raising taxation. And you get to 61% debt to GDP. And then comes the financial crisis. And then we're told that we have to bail out these banks because they're too big to fail. And in doing so, what you're basically doing is reinsuring the assets and the incomes of the people who have made off with most of the assets and the incomes over the past 30 years. And then we turn around and say, oh my goodness, debt to GDP is 90%. Didn't Reinhardt and Brockhoff write a paper telling us we'll all die at that point? We need to cut spending. And well, hang on a second, who is we and how did we get there? Because I don't remember anybody spending an orgy of public spending. I take Amtrak all the time, I would have noticed a fleet of high-speed trains flying across the country. No, it actually went to all the people who had all the cash to begin with, and now they want everybody else to pay for it. I call it that the greatest bait and switch in human history.
The idea of austerity you write about in your book is expressed by one advocate of austerity, John Cochrane of the University of Chicago. You cite him in your book. He's this prominent scholar and economist. And Cochrane is basically saying this, that when the government spends money, it crowds out the market for private investment. I mean, he says this. He says, for every dollar of increased government spending, that must correspond to one less dollar of private spending. And he says that jobs that are created by government spending, you know, stimulus spending, they get offset by lost jobs in the private sector. In other words, you can't do both. But you talk about how this concept is completely, how did you put it, completely and utterly wrong. Talk about the concept that we're hearing, this idea of austerity.
Well, the first concept you really have to get a handle on is the notion of, and it's an ugly term, a fallacy of composition. So let's think about it this way. Does it make sense for any one firm or one state or one family or anyone at all who's in debt to lower their debt? Of course it does. But we have to remember that someone's debt is someone else's income. And unless we're generating income, you're not actually saving. What you're doing is you're cannibalizing your own assets. So if everyone tries to save at the same time, no one is generating any income from which to save, and it becomes zero sum against itself. What's individually rational becomes collectively disastrous. That, in a nutshell, is what's been going on in the Eurozone for the past 4 years, which is why Greece, Portugal, Spain, and Ireland now have more debt than when they started, despite all the cuts they've been doing. So what Cochrane and others are talking about, a classical notion of crowding out investment, assumes a kind of one-for-one reciprocity. Right. But if the private sector is already deleveraging, paying back debt, they're not investing. And if you're in a recession, no one invests because, by definition, it's a recession. Who wants to invest in the middle of a recession? So you're withholding spending. So the argument is what the public sector needs to do is precisely at that time spend more or at least maintain its spending. This allows those incomes to be generated, which allows the private sector to effectively pay its debts back quicker and faster. And then you get the rebound. And of course, what we're meant to do at that point is when it withdraws, is the government spending is meant to go back down. Mm-hmm. We have the worst of all possible worlds. We don't believe that government spending should be done. And then when we do it through tax cuts, so we end up creating deficits.
So I've heard you describe it this way, that you have to kind of see the world as a series of balance sheets. You've got people, you've got households, you've got countries, and they all have, you know, you've got assets, you've got liabilities, those kinds of things. But you say there's a difference between the debt that I take on, for example, to pay bills, and the debt that a company takes on to make more money. I mean, there's a different way of looking at all of these, and we can't all be taking care of debt at the same time. Talk about this kind of series of balance sheets, if you would.
Sure, well, balance sheets are simply your assets and your liabilities and how they come out to basically a profit or a loss or an imbalance in them or whether they're balanced. So if you think about a household, its assets are its income, perhaps the mortgage that it has, and then it has its liabilities in terms of its outgoings. And this goes back to the same fallacy of composition. If everyone tries to pay back their mortgage all at once, what would happen to the mortgage market? It would collapse. If everyone tries to cut spending all at once, what happens to the stores where you go shopping? Those people are made unemployed. So what then happens to consumption in the overall economy? It goes down. That then comes back to your employer, and your employer says, well, hang on a minute, my balance sheet's looking pretty awful now because no one's buying my stuff. You need to take a wage cut. So you take a wage cut to stay in a job, and what happens? You have less consumption in the economy, and you begin to spiral down into a recession. Again, it simply goes back to this notion that what is individually rational can sometimes be collectively disastrous. And that is precisely what happens when you get into economic recessions. Because our first best instinct to tighten our belts, to not spend, is often the worst thing you can do. Because by doing so, you accelerate the deleveraging of the entire economy. And that is the recession you're trying to avoid. Your very actions bring about what you're trying to avoid.
Mm. I want to get into the particulars of that. Let me ask you sort of broadly, why do you figure austerity has become kind of the idea of the moment? You talk about how it's part of this is material, but also part of this is ideological. What's the ideological component? How did we get to this in an ideological way?
Well, the real story, is, as I go through in the book, is a couple of hundred years old. It goes all the way back to the foundations of capitalism, so I'm not sure you want to go there just now. But in short form, it goes like this. When you invent capitalism, and it was invented basically in England in the latter half of the 16th century and then spread across Europe and out into the world, you basically have a governmental system whereby the people who own things run things. It's not a democracy. Democracy comes very late to this story. And those people run the state, but at the same time they have all the assets, and there's a lot of inequality generated by markets. So they want a state that can effectively police those inequalities. Now here's the Second Amendment of the American Constitution. Any state that's strong enough to police those inequalities and protect you, as Adam Smith put it in The Wealth of Nations, for every one rich man there must be 500 poor, right. And were it not for the firm hand of the civil magistrate, he would never sleep in peace. So if that's the politics of the situation, you need a state that's strong enough to defend you. But any state that's strong enough to defend you can come and take your stuff, hence the Second Amendment. So how do you solve this problem? Because above all else, you don't really want to pay any taxes. Now, along comes a wonderful wheeze, and that wheeze is government debt. So government debt's an instrument whereby you lend the government some money, they give you the whole thing back, and they pay you interest through the term. And a fantastic thing. But David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, figured out the flaw in this plan. In order for that to work, you'd have to offer a rate of interest higher than you would get investing in a normal business. And it's also a very secure asset, so ultimately, everyone's going to invest in it. And you're going to get that kind of crowding out that Cochrane worried about. And what you're going to end up with is the productive economy shrinks, and you end up with nothing but debt securities all over the place, and we end up drowning in our debt. Now, it sounds like a plausible story, and in some countries it has happened. France around that period got into terrible trouble with debt. But the locus classicus here is England. So at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, when Hume and Smith died, they were predicting the bankruptcy of England. They had over 200% debt to GDP. That's like Japan today. And yet by 1867, it was down into the teens. Well, what happened? Well, the global economy exploded, and Britain was at the forefront. So what actually reduces debt is actual growth. It's not cuts. So think about it this way. The next time you're in Times Square and you see that terrible debt clock with all the numbers ticking forward and ticking forward, remember the size of the economy is what matters. The United States still hasn't paid back its debt from the Civil War. Doesn't have to, because it's about 100 times as big. So the debt is 100 times smaller. And the time value of money means that it's less and less over time. So basically, debt is a good thing so long as you keep it in control. Mm. Now we get to the conversation about, but it's out of control. Well, is it? Because the United States hasn't been cutting. And by 2016, we're going to be down to 71% from 90%. Meanwhile, in Europe, where they've been cutting 20 to 30% of GDP in the periphery, their debts have gone up by 30%. Isn't that funny?
Mm. It's interesting. The American economy, the debt, when you put that in perspective, I've also heard you talk about, for example, the marginal tax rate under Eisenhower, which you compare to today. Talk about that, if you would. I think that's interesting.
Sure.
Perspective.
Well, let's go back to what I was talking about. The United States federal government spends about 25% of GDP. Yeah. That's your Defense Department, roads, higher education subsidies, NIH, everything we spend cash on. But we only tax at about 17 or 18 because we've been cutting taxes since the 1980s. And everyone thinks they're taxed to death. Well, you know, here's the shock horror figures. When the United States was at its very zenith of global power, when it was 50% of the global economy,
right.
At that time under the Eisenhower administration, the top marginal tax rate of taxation was 91%.
Wow.
It was 87 with tax relief. Now, here's the difference. Hardly anyone paid that. Why? Because the whole income distribution was more equal. That was the growth of the American middle class. And on average, the people in the middle paid more, but there were more people on average in the middle, so they paid more. So you had higher rates, but effectively more people paid slightly more, but nowhere near the top. What we've got now is a situation whereby we've been cutting rates and cutting rates. Today, wealthy Americans pay less than they paid under Reagan. In fact, they pay less in marginal taxes than they pay under Nixon. So we basically created a situation where I like to call it fiscal teenagerism, where you want it all now, you want someone else to pay for it, and you're not going to admit that you actually consume more than you deliver, which is essentially where we are.
You mentioned in the book that the social mobility that societies like the United States and the United Kingdom, for example, that took for granted was due in part to government spending on social welfare. Again, this is one of those things that led a young man in poverty in Scotland to become an Ivy League university professor. This idea of spending on social welfare, that's from the 50s to the 1980s, I suppose, and then things mm-hmm. changed. So are we talking about an ideological? I mean, when did the idea of austerity start to emerge in sort of modern political terms?
Well, go back to what I was talking about earlier with Hume and Smith and all these guys.
Yeah.
That's kind of the origins of this. But you don't really have an austerity panic or austerity as a response until you have states that are big enough to cut. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't really happen until you get into the early 20th century. Why? Because you have democracy. And with democracy comes claims for redistribution of assets. That's the whole point of democracy. So you get this type of redistribution going on, particularly in the post-war period. And then around the 70s and the 80s, when there's a squeeze on profits and corporations, what was called stagflation, the simultaneous occurrence of unemployment and inflation in the economy. In a sense, throughout the developed world, business struck back. And you had the growth of things like the American Enterprise Institute and the refunding of the Republican Party in the United States and the whole sort of rebirth of business literature, etc. And the whole thing's markets good, states bad. And economics retools itself this way and undergoes what's called the neoclassical revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been living this sort of neoliberal period for the past 30 years. And the idea is basically downsize, stop spending, privatize, integrate, liberalize, and everything will be great. Well, the only problem is an ugly distributional story in that, which is about 90% of the gains of those 30 years have gone to the top 10%. And within that top 10%, the top 10% of that, the fabled 1%, really have made off with most of it. The bottom end of the American income distribution hasn't had a real wage increase when you adjust for inflation and exclude the importation of deflation from China, which is basically the Walmart effect on prices, since 1979. So we have an extraordinarily unequal society. And at the same time, if you decide it, those on top refuse to pay taxes and those on the bottom don't have enough to pay. Let's remember that for all this cry, hue and cry about the top 1% paying most of the taxes, well, they should because they have most of the money. There's 50 million Americans living in a household that earns less than $22,300 a year. How are they actually meant to pay taxes on incomes that low? So when you have that skew and you no longer have Pell Grants that effectively buy education goods and you have education costs which are per year more than many families earn, in fact almost as much as the median income, you're effectively creating that insider game. And those at the bottom simply don't get a share or at least a chance to have a share in the prosperity. And that's the real problem. Social mobility in the United States is effectively ground to a halt. That's the bad news. Intergenerationally, you're far more likely now to have your father's income than at any time since the 19th century. So if you happen to be born rich, you're going to do very well statistically. If you happen to be born poor, your chances of becoming rich are extremely small. That's really dangerous for capitalism, which I actually believe in and actually want to work, because I'm the perfect example of what happens when it does work.
Mm.
And I'll give you this as a closer on this thought. Because of the investment that was made in me by the British welfare state, even though I left and came to the United States, I'm now relatively skilled And because of that, I earn more money. And because of that, I pay more taxes. I have paid back in tax money already everything the state ever gave to me. And I will continue to do so until the day I die. That investment paid off very nicely. The welfare state is not a dead loss. It's an investment in mobility and your future.
Mark Blythe is with us. He's a professor of international political economy at Brown University, author of the book Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the wake of the Great Recession, large Western governments have tried to keep their economies afloat by imposing austerity measures. The hope is that by reducing wages and spending, you can bail your country out of budget deficits and you can jumpstart global economic growth. Well, the political economist Mark Blythe says that plan, in fact, hasn't worked out. He says austerity has just led to sluggish growth and increased inequality. He's joining us today to talk about his book. It's called Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. So, Mark Blythe, I'm trying to get a sense of how the idea of austerity has gained purchase in, you know, the academy. We mentioned John Cochrane, for example. I want to go back to him for a moment because I wanted to get you to respond to his impressions of your argument. He wrote this response to Paul Krugman, who I know shares many of your ideas about austerity. And Cochrane wrote this. He says, imagine this were a respected scientist who says most basically that everything everyone has done in this field since the 1960s is a complete waste of time. Everything that fills its academic journals, is taught in its PhD programs, is presented at its conferences, summarized in its graduate textbooks, all of this is totally wrong. Instead, this person calls for a return to the eternal verities of a rather convoluted book written in the 1930s. I guess a reference there to Keynes. But how do you respond to this kind of reaction? Because I'm sure you're seeing this kind of thing.
Well, without getting into the rhetorical bombardment involved in that particular quote, let's get down to what this really is saying.
Yeah.
There's one school of economics that comes from Adam Smith and has never changed its tune, and it says that everybody acting in their own self-interest produces a world that's better than everybody trying to coordinate their actions effectively. Right. That's the argument against planning, it's the argument for markets, etc., etc. And in certain circumstances, it's true. It's absolutely true, but not all circumstances. And there's another school of thought that says, you know, there are sometimes when that invisible hand of Adam Smith kind of has arthritis. And that's what happens when you have panics in financial markets. That's what happens when you have recessions and everybody tries to tighten their belt at once. Because what seems to happen is, as I said before, your own first best action leads you to a second best outcome. And that's precisely the outcome you're trying to avoid. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the thing. In different situations, they're both true. There are certain situations where markets tick along fine. They don't need intervention by any third-party government or otherwise. And they tend to be relatively simple markets with good transparency and good prices and all the rest of it. And then there are markets, such as derivatives markets and financial markets, whereby you seem to have all those things, and yet they're prone to sudden stops and collapses. Exchange rate regimes are another one. And we could think of economic recessions, etc. So there's room for both of these things to exist. The battle is essentially which world do we live in right now and which one matters for policy. And I'm of the mind that says the Adam Smith story is a nice story, but ultimately it's a bit of a fairy story.
Let's take a call. Eloise is with us in Salt Lake. Eloise, welcome.
Hello. I want to thank you for having this very important topic on, and I agree with Mr. Delias. Your theories on this, and you know, Paul Krugman believes the same way. And I'm wondering, these are simple concepts to understand, I think. And I'm wondering why you think the politicians, mostly conservatives, but both parties, believe in pursuing the policy of austerity when really it that policy to me hurts everybody's bottom line except for the people at the very top.
That's a good question. Pretty basic question, Mark Blythe. What do you think?
I think that Eloise has answered her own question, basically. The people who fund campaigns, who fund elections, who fund the lobbyists, the people written about in this wonderful book that's just come out called This Town about DC, which I encourage everyone to read, they're exactly the people who don't want to pay for the mess that they've made. So let's go back to the financial crisis.
Yeah.
You build giant institutions which are levered up the wazoo. That is to say that for every dollar they have in reserve as a cushion, they have around $30 out there as loans and other deals. Those deals all go sour all at once, despite the fact that these markets are meant to be self-calibrating and they're meant to adjust for risk and so on and so forth. And that basically means everyone's going to lose their shirt. So they go screaming to whom? Do they rely on themselves? Do they rely on the market? No, they go running home to the state and they say, you have to bail me. And when you say you have to bail me, what you're basically saying is the taxpayer, the normal guy, has to bail me. So you pay once through taxation for the bailouts. You pay second through the recession. And now they want you to pay for the cost of this through current government services, which you rely on because you consume them, whereas they don't. I think you've answered your own question. That's exactly what's going on.
We decided to bail out the system, as you say. Give us a sense of how much that cost. What do you figure was the cost for the United States?
Well, the cost of it is actually not the issue you should focus on. I mean, it depends how you cost it. You could say that at one point the Federal Reserve had $13 trillion of loan guarantees at risk in the global financial system. Well, as the world's largest economy and as the Fed is essentially the world's central bank because it prints the global reserve asset, the dollar, that's kind of what it's meant to do, so that's irrelevant. The real scandal here is what we have is a moral hazard problem, is a business model. And here's what I mean by this. When you go to the airport and they ask you if you want a rental car, you say, sure. They say, do you want to buy insurance? And you say, no, I have my own. And sometimes you say, oh, I'll take the comprehensive. And when you take the comprehensive, you drive that thing into the ground. You don't care what you do to it, the whole thing. So imagine basically a banking license does the same thing. And it becomes so big that if it fails, it takes out about 40% or 50% of GDP. Because that's the size of these large American banks. European banks are even bigger, by the way, three times the size and twice as levered. And that's why the Europe's in the mess it's in. But to stick with this one. So essentially, you've built too big to fail as a business model because you say, hey, if I fall over, you guys have to bail me out. So what I'll do is I'll fall over and you'll bail me out. And you won't really be able to change anything. And I'll do it again. And that'll give me a cost of capital funding advantage. That'll make me more attractive to investors. That'll enable me to take more risks and make bigger bonuses. And if it all goes wrong, you will continue to bail me out. So the scandal in this has nothing to do with the money that was spent or was earned or whatever. It's the fact that we basically have an immoral problem as a business model for the financial sector. And I think that's fundamentally wrong.
What would have been the approach then? Would you not bail them out? What's the response after everything collapses in 2008? The proper
response? It's entirely plausible that you could price out after the fact all of the derivatives trades. And then you do a process called netting. Basically, there's someone on one side of the trade and someone on the other side of the trade, and it nets out. So the numbers you hear of like $50 trillion, like you net it out, it's actually much smaller. So it's possible that the bang that happened wouldn't have been as bad as people say. But even if you decide it is, what do you then do? Well, you bail them, sure, but then you fail them. You shut them down as failing businesses. And if people have been running essentially an extortion racket as a business model, you're meant to send them to jail. And what do we have today? Well, we have the situation whereby this guy Fabrice, who was dumb enough to put his name on email celebrating how clever he was with mortgage derivatives, he's got a civil suit against him where he's the guy the SEC is going after. So you've got one guy at the end of this, the first guy who's really been nailed by the SEC. His firm, which was doing all this stuff, Goldman, paid a $500 million fine and walked away and never admitted any guilt. So we failed them, or we bailed them rather, but we didn't fail them and we certainly didn't send them to jail.
It's interesting. There's another bit of perspective that you've offered before. You point out back in, I think it was 2000, that the biggest global economic concern, you say, was that there wasn't going to be enough federal debt.
I know. Isn't that ironic?
Because we'd balance the budget.
Yeah, absolutely. So you got to remember that the U.S. prints the global reserve asset. What does that mean? It means that the dollar is what international trade is conducted in.
Okay.
So if you print another currency, you have to use that to trade to earn dollars because other people you trade with want their settlement in dollars. This gives us an immense sort of structural power in the global economy. And when federal debt is going down and down and down, you're balancing the budget, this is actually a problem because people like federal debt. It sits at the bottom of bank portfolios. It anchors derivatives contracts. It's a reserve asset. Central banks are filled with the thing because it's more easily, You can use it easier than gold, for example. So dollars and dollar-denominated assets are really important. So back in the day, we were actually worried about running out of debt. And then we're having a panic about we're going to drown in debt. Now, here's the really fascinating thing about this over the past 5 years. We've been running a natural experiment globally. Because you have the United States, and it's gridlocked, which means the people who want to cut haven't been able to. And what's happened is federal debt has gone from 90% down to 2016, 70%. So it's the fastest debt reduction we've seen in a generation. The deficit by the end of this year will be around 4% and going towards 3%. That's normal. In fact, it's good. Why? Because we didn't cut. Now, you've got the Brits. They have their own currency. They've got their own central bank. They have all the advantages, but they decided with Osborne and Cameron to squeeze. Their economy has flatlined for 5 years. Their deficit's going to be twice the size of ours, and their debt's got bigger. And then you go to Europe. Greece has lost 30% of GDP due to cuts. The Wehrmacht didn't do that to them in World War II. Spain and Portugal and other countries, around 20% of GDP loss. You have 26 million unemployed across Europe that doesn't need to be there because of these policies. You have a generation without work. You have 50% youth unemployment. And their economies are falling off a cliff. And guess what happens? As the GDP of the economy, the size of the economy shrinks, the same amount of debt gets bigger, not smaller. Last year, Greece's debts went up by around 18 to 24%. Spain's went up, Ireland's went up, and they're cutting. So we have clear evidence, as clear as you could possibly wish, that not only does this not work, it's actually counterproductive. And yet we keep doing it. That goes back to our caller's question, in whose interest is this?
Is it a useful comparison to compare the United States against Europe, for example? Because you've talked about Europe. I mean, they're in a particularly difficult situation. Unlike the United States, they cannot, or it's more difficult anyway, to, you know, you can't get your way out of the crisis by inflating, for example. It's, you know, you have to have a printing press, as you said. You can't devalue. I mean, you know, you have to have your own currency for that. If you're, you know, separate, you can do it. Europe can do it collectively, but not individually. So all you have in some ways is austerity. Is that the United States should be different in some ways? I mean, what's the comparison between those two?
Well, the comparison is valid if you look at it this way. They're both about $15 trillion, 17 in the euro sense, for their GDP. Their bank assets in the euro are about three times GDP, twice GDP in the U.S. Bank leverage about half what it is in the U.S. as opposed to the euro. So the euro is kind of like the eurozone, I should say. It's like a turbocharged U.S. Mm-hmm. Now, why is it different? It's different because, A, we have their global reserve asset, and, B, they have this thing called the European Central Bank. Now, everything you said there, you can't inflate your way out because you don't have a printing press. You can't devalue because you don't have a printing press. So France has 230% of GDP in three banks, and it can't bail them because it doesn't have a printing press because it gave it to the Germans in Frankfurt with the ECB. That's what we're talking about. Now, when the politicians in Europe saw that the crisis was washing onto their shores and the Greeks came out and said, hey, turns out we've been lying about our debts and deficits, the markets panicked. And the markets panicked because they said, hang on a minute, I know that Ben Bernanke is going to stand behind dollar-denominated debt, but who actually stands behind this because it's not a country? And that's where it becomes different. So when the yields started to spike, they were spiking because they were worried about breakup risk. You're holding all these euro bonds and euro issues, and guess what? They go to zero because the euro no longer exists because the countries decide they don't want to do it. Now, that was what actually happened. The politicians' response was, therefore austerity, we need to cut these budgets. Right. Well, here's the weird thing. The debts have been going up and up and up, and the yields have been going down and down and down. So if the whole point is to reduce debt, not only has it been a failure, it also has nothing to do with the yields going down. So why did the bond yields go down? Because it got rid of a guy called Trichet, who was obsessed with fighting an inflation that died in 1976 in the middle of a deflation today. And we got a guy called Draghi. And Draghi came along and gave the banks enough liquidity to keep them whole. And most importantly said, I'll do whatever it takes to save the euro. And the markets went, whew, and the yields went down. None of that central bank policy has anything to do with Ireland cutting its housing benefit, and yet we continue to do it. It's a bit like diagnosing yourself with a broken leg and checking yourself in for homeopathy. It might make you feel good for a few minutes, but ultimately you're not really addressing the problem.
Mm. It's interesting, if you look at the United States, the attention to doing something about Social Security, wanting to cut entitlements in the context of all of this, you've talked about how that seems really ridiculous.
It is totally ridiculous. So the Social Security is going bankrupt. There was something from the Peterson Foundation's watchdog on this stuff. They're one of the guys that are always filling up the debt panic stuff. And they actually said something like, I think it was by 2087, Social Security would be 1.64% of GDP. Like, you've got to be kidding me, right? This is your version of a panic? By that time, the Klingons might have invaded. I will be dead through natural causes, and yet you're worrying about it? What's going on here? So there's a great deal of debt mongering and debt panicking going on. And it's basically just people with all the cash and all the assets saying, I don't want to pay for anything. It's back to that fiscal teenagerism.
You do, because you do say in the book, you point this out, debt does in fact matter. It's important to take care of it. The point is doing it in the proper way.
Look, cutting in a recession is literally bloodletting. All you're doing is weakening the economy. That's what Europe shows. Not doing it is what America shows, and America is growing and Europe is not. It's really quite simple. There's not only nothing wrong with paying back your debt, it's a good idea, but do it from a position of strength. Do it when you're generating income. But this is fiscal teenagerism again, because as soon as we generate income, it's like, let's have another round of tax cuts. It's the people's money, it's not our money. Forgetting, of course, that what happened was the public sector balance sheet, state spending, expanded the last time was a recession so that you kept your job. So what you're meant to do is you're meant to basically spend when it's hurting and then save when it's not. When it's sunny, you're meant to repair the roof. We take the roof off and declare it a cabriolet.
Mark Blythe is with us. His book is called Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. We need to take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Mark Blythe. We're talking about his book, Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. So I guess when you're talking about the alternative to austerity, or alternatives to austerity, you've talked about that it's not necessarily the response to spend. You say the first point is just stop doing it.
Exactly. I prefer to call it Hippocratic economics. First, do no harm. This is self-harm. Again, let me go back to the example of the Eurozone. They continue to do themselves harm. Now, we've got to wonder why this is. Well, you can talk about northern countries. There were the creditors that didn't spend enough domestically. Their savings went into the banking sector. The banking sector bought bonds from Spain and Portugal. That gave these guys gobs of cheap money, which they then used to buy BMWs. Mm-hmm. And it was a wonderful little credit pump until it broke, and now we have a creditor-debtor standoff, and that's really the politics of it. And the problem is, at the end of the day, the more the creditors squeeze when the debtors have no money, the less likely it is that the debtors will ever pay back the money. So it becomes utterly self-defeating, and the creditors end up paying themselves more in the long run than if they had a sensible adjustment up front. So the first thing is just stop doing it. It's not about running out and spending gajillion dollars of government money and adding to the debt and so on and so forth. The damage that has been done in some of the periphery European countries, that might be a good idea, just to simply restore incomes back to a normal level or even half normal level. But in most countries, you don't have to do this. Just stop doing it, because it's just a bad policy. So no great plans, no giant planning bureaus, no new state bureaucracies, no massive initiatives, just stop doing it. God bless gridlock. Look at what has happened in the US. Because we can't agree on what to cut, we don't, apart from the idiotic sequester, which means that we're basically driving a Ferrari with a handbrake on. And if it wasn't for that, we'd be growing at around 3.4 to 3.6%, and then unemployment would be coming down faster. But even with the handbrake on, we're still moving forward. Europe is charging back 20 miles an hour in reverse.
Let's go back to the phones. Dave is with us in Park City. Dave, welcome.
Question is, how does he account for debt, aging debt, and bad debt as a factor of growth or percentage of?
Could you be a little bit more specific?
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
Sure. If we take the numbers and say we have 3%, 4% growth, it doesn't seem that they're adding back bad debt, aging debt, right, as it gets older, or even the billions in debt that the government has as a sort of break growth, meaning there's no accounting. How is he accounting for that?
Well, I mean, a lot of this, if you do this, what's called the infinite horizon projection, then basically we're already broke and we should all be dead because we'll never have enough money to pay for the debts we've accumulated. But by that token, it's a bit like saying, well, World War II is coming up. We know we're going to end up with a lot of debt, so let's not fight Japanese imperialism. You take on debt when you have to, and then what happens over time is that basically the economy grows, and as the economy keeps growing, the same constant stock of debt gets smaller. I gave the example earlier on that we still haven't paid back the debt from the Civil War, and we don't need to because it's such a tiny, tiny percentage relative to the size of the economy now. So aging debt is actually a good thing because it stays constant while the economy gets bigger. Therefore, reciprocally, the debt as a proportion of GDP gets smaller, which is why growth cures debt, whereas cuts on their own, if you're in a recession, do not. Cuts, if you're growing, are totally fine. We did it in 94 through 97. The British government did it in 97 to 2001. Even the Italians did it under Prodi in the early 90s. Debt to GDP in the OECD was going down before the crisis, not up. Never mind the rhetoric. Look at the numbers. But in general, basically, I don't really see a problem. So long as the economy is growing, the debt gets smaller.
You've talked about smart spending and stupid spending. One of the things you have talked about, okay, so one of the ideas, okay, just stop doing austerity, you say, but there are some spending ideas that you think about, which is, I think you've talked about infrastructure, dealing with infrastructure as a kind of low-cost productivity enhancement, I think is how you've put it.
Yeah, I mean, a simple one. I work in Providence, but I live in Boston. So I have to drive. Now, why do I have to drive? I have to drive because I got daycare. So I got to be back home half the time to pick up kids in daycare. Now, I'd love to take the train, but here's the problem. Amtrak doesn't own the tracks. So a CSX freight train owned by Warren Buffett gets in front of the train that's coming from Virginia. I get to the train station, and it's an hour and a half late. So I can't take the train. So that means I have to take the car. So that means I have to get on 95 and then 93. And that means, along with thousands of other Bostonians, we're all stuck in traffic, not contributing except to global warming through our tailpipes. So maybe if we actually invested in high-speed rail and got the damn thing sorted out, it would be productivity-enhancing for that entire corridor, which is a very intensive wealth-generating part of the United States, which would lead both to more growth, more jobs, and, crucially, more tax revenue, which would allow you to pay back the debt.
Mm. What are you hearing from the Obama administration, for example? It seems like, on some ways, you get a sense that there are sort of half-measures, that you can do a little bit of both. But, you know, you can cut, but also that you don't need to go completely all the way. I mean, do half measures work in things like this?
Well, half measures are a bit like driving a Ferrari with a handbrake on. I mean, basically having all the advantages of the United States and then having a sequester. We would be reducing debt faster if it wasn't for the sequester because we'd be growing faster. And that's really the simple truth of it. The sequester itself is nothing but a drag on our growth rate, which ultimately means it's going to take longer to pay off the same amount of debt. So these half measures, you know, basically one step forward and one step back, means that you end up standing in the same place. Now, thanks to the size, dynamism, and robustness of the United States economy, we're still growing. But that's not the only problem that we have. Think about it this way. Let's go back to the earlier stories we were talking about, income inequality and also social mobility. You get to a point now where student debt becomes a real issue for people. What if people stop going to college? Well, so long as basically the ticket to a middle-class income is to have a college degree, you're effectively not just pricing people out of it. You're reducing, effectively, your skills pool. So you have less people going to university, not just to do middle-class jobs in general, but to be engineers, to be scientists. You're going to hit your productivity in that way. So those types of expenditures are investments in the economy overall, not just subsidies to people for goods they can no longer afford. So we need to think creatively about this in terms of how we actually best grow the economy, rather than just thinking about, oh, the terrible debt and we need to slash things to get it down, because it simply doesn't work.
Mm. You've talked about how demography matters, that the United States and other countries, for that matter, need to calibrate their government programs to the realities. Are we pretty off kilter in that sense, you think?
Well, Social Security, despite all the hype, you're not. I mean, simply raise the payroll cap to 117,000, and it's funded as long as planet Earth will be around. This is all just nonsense. So there are certain programs that are not problems. There are certain ones that are. Medicare is a disaster. It basically enriches doctors and impoverishes the taxpayer. Meanwhile, Medicare Part D, which was simply the Republicans' last attempt to blow up Medicare by planting a bomb in the middle of it, is another fiscal train wreck. So there are certain things that we really do need to pay attention to, but none of that has anything to do with the federal deficit. So why are we including it even in the calculation? Oh, no, we don't, but we try and cut them at the same time. Why? Sounds like politics.
Back to the phones. Ed is with us in Salt Lake. Ed, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question. It's been burning on my mind for a long time, and I appreciate the opportunity to ask it. I'm trying to figure out why the Central European Bank doesn't reduce the value of the euro to try and make it more competitive in the marketplace, you know, more like on a one-to-one basis with the dollar, so that, you know, all the southern European nations that mostly are geared towards tourism, it would really increase their tourism, I would think.
Good question. Part of the reason is the Americans won't let them, because if they do, then that makes America less competitive. Ultimately, devaluation is kind of zero-sum, one country against the other. But even if they did that, the situation's complex. What you have in the north are countries like Germany that are super competitive exporters. So if you were to devalue the euro, the BMW that you buy over here in the US would get even cheaper. So you'd buy even more of them. So the Germans would get richer, but they don't consume enough. So what would they do? They would basically save more. Now, what is in the story in the southern Europe? Well, apart from northern Italy, they don't actually have much that is globally competitive. They have agriculture and tourism. They used to have banking services, but that's not going so well now. So basically, what do these guys have? Well, they might get more tourists, but at the same time, they're going to have a problem because they don't really have anything that they can sell that's going to help those national economies. So again, it becomes win-win for the north and lose-lose for the south. The third reason is central banks around the world hold about 30 to 40% of their reserves in euros. Nobody wants that exchange rate to go down because it means those reserves are worth less.
Ed, thanks for the call. Here's an email from Kate, who's wondering, how do religious views of punishment and moral superiority play into the United States and their calls for austerity? I guess maybe even more broadly, Mark Blythe, are there cultural components to all of this, you know, religious, ideological components that play into austerity?
Oh, absolutely. Let me give you two examples. If you want a fabulous book, a great read on this, Jim Marone, my colleague in political science at Brown, wrote this wonderful book called Hellfire Nation, which is all about the United States' relationship with religion and morality. And basically, there's a very strong, like, American liberalism goes with a sort of, like, how can I put it, millenarian Protestantism, that you're either in the end times or you're a sinner. So the profligate is always just one step away from ruin, and we'll all be like that unless we're very careful. Now, that's kind of there, but it's also kind of a little bit, I'm not really sure. Now, on the other hand, I'll give you an example from Europe. This one's fascinating, and I found this out from reading a dissertation that a German guy did last year. And he pointed out the following really obvious thing, which I had never really thought about. So if you go back to the 1940s, when Germany was cut in half, the population that was left were Catholics. For the first time, Catholics were the majority, West Germany. And Catholics have a kind of organic conception of society coming from papal encyclicals, etc. You look after the poor. So these guys have no problem with the welfare state, so they built a big one. Now, at the end of the Cold War, the East Germans came back. They were all the Protestants. What's been happening since then is that welfare state in Germany is becoming a lot more threadbare and a lot more focused on traditional issues, and these days is even trying to keep women out of the labour market by subsidising their childcare so that the unemployment figures look better. So those cultural aspects are certainly important, but are they driving things? I don't think so.
Kate, thanks very much. So let me ask you, Mark Blythe, I wonder... who's paying attention to you in the real sense, in terms of politically? I mean, are you starting to get some attention for these? I mean, Paul Krugman talks about this, of course. You talk about these kinds of things. But how is that – what's the debate you're hearing, I suppose, for all of this in real terms, in political terms, for example?
Well, I mean, it's less about me. I'm sort of hopefully part of the chorus of reason. But, you know, reason alone doesn't win out. I like to put it this way, that sometimes mere facts never get in the way of a good ideology. So we have a situation now in the United States where the deficit is falling at record pace. And what happens is people are ratcheting up even more. I mean, let's imagine that we end up with a balanced budget 5 years out. Just imagine, because it did happen before in 2000. So, you know, it could happen again. And we end up back down to 60% GDP debt to GDP. Do you think Paul Ryan's going to stop doing his budget? He's going to be back every year. We just need to kill everything. And that's just the way that politics goes. For some people, this is an end in itself. So the notion that this is a debate about policy, yeah, it might be true at the margins, that like we can talk about timing, calibration, whether you should raise taxes or cut spending, what's the optimal response. And that's very much the economics debate. But the policy debate is basically two biblical schools, where one is saying, you must cut everything. And the other one is saying, no, you must spend, spend, spend. And that's a caricature of what the real issues at stake are. Unfortunately, the caricature is driving politics. It's not a debate. It's a long-range oratorical bombardment. So I'm not trying to influence. I'm just trying to clarify and bring a degree of sanity to what is otherwise a poisonous debate.
But you sound skeptical, though, that it's going to, that people are going to listen.
Well, what will make it work is when the euro basically either grinds on in its current form for another 5 or 6 years with chronically high unemployment and chronically low growth, and eventually you have a political reaction in one of the southern countries that we really don't like, by which I mean nationalist, populist, quasi-fascistic, which is entirely possible. Centre parties, the centre-left and centre-right, have been losing votes in droves, and the parties of the extreme-right and extreme-left are the ones that are gaining strength. So we do see sort of real political risk being built into this system. And ultimately, you know, as I like to put it, things continue till they don't. So austerity can continue for a long time. I hope that my voice and others give people pause so that we realise we have choices to make. We have policies that we need to design. We have entitlements that we need to take care of. But it's not about the rhetoric, and it's not about the long-range argument. It's about just actually facing the facts.
Mark Blythe. This book is called Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. Joined us from a studio in Brookline, Massachusetts. Professor, thanks very much for the time.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.